grisly one.
Their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
It must be like Putin.
Seven minutes after the hour of five, and let me tell you, it is cold out there. The hawk is talking. Boy, they expect, Bill Evans said, temperatures to drop well below freezing, and there could be ice, snow, and sleet throughout the weekend. Obviously, not as many people interested in the Super Bowl this year as in past years. I hate both teams, the Philadelphia Criminal Eagles. Bunch of thugs. And naturally, the New England Patriots, led by the Brady Bunch and Coach Belichick, I hate them too. And I've been a lifelong Giant fan, so you can't be rooting for the Philadelphia Eagles. And as a Jet fan, you can't be rooting for the Patriots. So it basically cancels out here. But as we're high atop Madison Square Garden, these great facilities provided to us in order to broadcast to all of you in this nice and warm and toasty facility by NJDiet.com, I noticed that today is National Wear Red Day. And I got a lot of competition out there with my red beret and red sateen jacket as leader of the worldwide group of Guardian Angels, although this has to do really more about promoting heart disease, which is the number one killer in America, having surpassed cancer and other forms of scenarios that lead to Americans dying. So I've exempted all of you. Go ahead, wear red today. But it does remind me, since we talked about Putin and Russia and the cloud that hangs over Washington, D.C. because of the ongoing investigations, that there was a phrase coming out of the Cold War when I was a kid. And we were underneath our desks. And naturally, we thought at any moment, as Nikita Khrushchev was saying in the General Assembly, we will bury you. You know, naturally, as he was all ginned up with vodka, that those that supported the Soviet Union would say it's better red than dead. Oh, yeah, there were people like Paul Robeson. I'm reminded of that every time I'm in downtown Newark passing the law school of Rutgers. In fact, I believe Paul Robeson had attended Rutgers, an All-American tight end, and a great operatic voice that he had. But he went to bed with Father Joe Stalin, and he bought that propaganda, and he actually believed it would be better red than dead. Now, the only reason I mention that is because there have been allegations galore that some, small handful, of those that had assisted Donald Trump in his campaign, in which he eventually became president of the United States, had interests of Russia and doing business with Russia more so than what might benefit America. And so today we saw a four-page drop. It was by the offices of the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Devin Nunes, who had recused himself from the investigation, so a staff member wrote it up. It was released right before I came on the air at 12 with Juliette Huddy. But to be honest with you, it needs to be fleshed out. It really needs an explanation because naturally, depending on your political ideology, you might be taking the attitude of Congressman Stephen King in Iowa.
Then what I saw and what I believe happened could go on in perpetuity and we become a banana republic. What this is earth-shaking, and it does go deeper than Watergate, and the memo doesn't
deeper
answer it all
Watergate.
By any means.
How is it deeper than Watergate?
Deeper than Watergate. And how is it deeper? Because the FBI and the DOJ, by the information that I have observed and the testimony that I have, I'm going to say the testimony that I have analyzed from listening to and questioning multiple members of the FBI and the DOJ, tells me that the FBI and DOJ have been weaponized.
Oh, boy. On the line to explain this memo is Dan McLaughlin. He's a lawyer and columnist for the National Review. Thanks for jumping on board here on the Drive Home at 5, Dan.
Glad to be here.
All right, you just heard Congressman Stephen King of Iowa. From what you've seen so far, is this approaching Watergate levels?
It's really not. And, you know, it all depends what you're expecting from this memo. My takeaway from this is, you know, it's not a nothing burger, but it's a White Castle burger. If this is all you got, you're going to come away hungry. But there is something real here. You know, Nunes has really laid out the case, at least if you believe everything that's in the memo, that opposition research paid for by the Democrats was presented to the FBI and the DOJ and presented by them to the court without saying where it had come from, at least in terms of without disclosing the funding. And that was used to get a warrant to eavesdrop and surveil on Carter Page, who had been a volunteer, really a fairly low-level unpaid volunteer, more of a hanger-on than anything else with the Trump camp. So, you know, the idea that there was high-level, you know, Obama administration spying on the Trump campaign, I don't see that out of this. But the idea that this started all of the Russia investigation, no, it clearly didn't. Clearly they even the Nunes memo itself admits that there was already some ongoing investigations based on Mr. Papadopoulos, because apparently, according if you believe the New York Times, Papadopoulos had, you know, been having a few drinks and blabbed to the wrong guy, and that got things started. So what you do have here is, I think, the improper use of partisan dirty tricks to start up surveillance. What I don't think you have is some sort of grand conspiracy or, you know, a great penetration of the Trump campaign.
Well, now, since the memo was dropped and the name Andrew McCabe is glaring in terms of what he is being accused of, the former deputy director of the FBI who just resigned, you know, there's been a buzz of people saying, well, that's why he resigned early. That's why he left before his retirement date in March, because he knew this would implicate him. What exactly does this report say about the former deputy director of the FBI?
I think this is not the big shoe to drop on him, because there's also an inspector general investigation on McCabe within the DOJ, and the inspector general report may have more to say about him, but obviously, and the fact that McCabe, you know, his wife had taken all these donations from basically Hillary Clinton's bag man before he joined, and then he went ahead and joined the investigation anyway. Where McCabe is a little bit in the crossfire here, though, I mean, there's a bunch of people named as having signed off on these FISA applications, and he's one of them. The big dispute is that Nunes' memo says that McCabe basically admitted under oath that the Steele dossier, the opposition research package, was essential to them originally getting the warrant. And some of the Democrats are pushing back, saying, well, no, that's not exactly what he said, although it's hard to, if you read between the lines, it almost seems like the Democrats are trying to change the subject by saying, well, you know, it's a question of did this start the investigation or not? And that's not what Nunes is talking about. He's saying that McCabe admitted that this was essential to the application.
All right. Now, Dan, explain this. They're deciding to put a bug on Carter Page, who had traveled back and forth to Russia before he joined the campaign, and naturally he resigned because of the controversy, and they get this FISA warrant. Hypothetically, if a Lieutenant General Flynn had called him, or Bannon, or anyone else, and the FBI is listening to this conversation, are they supposed to stop listening because it doesn't involve a foreign agent, or do they continue to tape it and listen to it?
I think that they do have to, there are some situations where they have to back off. It may depend on the nature of the warrant. You know, the main purpose of these, what if they have the warrant, though, they can keep listening. The area where the administration sometimes has the scope to go outside of FISA, and this is the big fight that they had, you know, when Bush was president, was that they wanted the ability to listen in without a warrant. And if you're listening without a warrant, you absolutely can only listen to foreign nationals' conversations.
So I thought originally that this would lead to someone suggesting, either within the DOJ or the FBI, that the citizen Trump, candidate Trump, should be listened to, that the, this warrant might actually extend to him or some of his upper echelon. Now, we just have the four-page memo. Are we to believe it's only this, or might there be something bigger and grander within the complete report?
Well, obviously, the fact that this happened certainly makes you wonder if other things happened that we've never found out about, but it doesn't sound to me like anybody in Nunes or his circle is talking about, you know, any other specific examples. So that's why I think that this is, you know, within the four corners of this situation, I think it's a pretty ugly situation for what the, you know, what the FBI did. But if this is all there is, and it looks like this may be all there is on this particular front, that's why I think this is a scandal, but it's not a very large scandal. And, you know, you mentioned McCabe. The other guy who sticks out here, actually jumps out of this, is a fellow named Bruce Orr, who's then the associate deputy attorney general. And apparently he seems to have been the guy working heavily with Steele. And while apparently Orr's own wife was employed by the same opposition research firm doing dirt digging on Trump. So it's, you know, there's more than a few moving parts here that are troublesome.
Well, thank you, Dan McLaughlin, lawyer and columnist for the National Review, for connecting the dots without being impassioned one way or the other, because everybody immediately has an opinion. And I don't think necessarily most understand it. To me, it's still a ball of confusion.
Imus in the morning.
So far, so good.
And the drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air. Online. On the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good.
There is good. There is good. There is untapped good. Like inside, the worst of us is good.
Oh, so good, West Side Story. The Jets and the Sharks and Officer Krumke, old school. I guess you couldn't call him Irish with the name Krumke, but let's face it, back then, you're talking San Juan Hill, over where the whole Lincoln Center area is now, as it was demolished and Lincoln Center was built up to replace it. That's where these groups clashed, Puerto Ricans and mostly Irish at the time. But out of it came the battle that was very typical back then between police officers and teenagers. Well, today, there is no battle at the turnstiles in the subway system in Manhattan, because Cyrus White Shoes Vance, the district attorney, who is always into pay for play, as long as you can contribute to campaigns that he doesn't run because nobody ever challenges him, he's more than happy to make sure that your case goes away. Just look at Harvey Weinstein, right? He still hasn't been indicted by that bum Vance. But he made a statement in September. And he said, because it's mostly poor black and Hispanic youth of color who get busted for fare evasion, for turnstile jumping, that it would no longer be a crime that would necessitate a collar, meaning by a cop who then would arrest the person and put him through the system or give him a desk appearance ticket, a.k.a. a disappearance ticket. And then just yesterday, cops said of the NYPD, now, wait a second, if we're not going to be able to arrest fare evaders, turnstile jumpers, and you're telling us instead we should just write a ticket as if they had just dropped trash on the platform in the subway, I think that fine now is $125. You can forget about it, because we give them beef, they're going to want to bust our teeth, because they're going to know we don't follow up with an arrest if they're giving us all kinds of problems. So as of right now, there will be no arrests, no ticketable offenses in the borough of Manhattan when you decide to be a fare evader or jump the turnstile or act as if you're in the Irish sweepstakes. You go under the turnstile, over the turnstile, through the emergency gate. How many times have we seen, mostly young men, but sometimes others, they queue up near the token booth. They listen for an incoming or an outgoing train, depending on what they're going to catch. And the moment they see the first vestiges of that train, boom, they bum rush. Sometimes it's as many as 20 or 30 people just running towards the train to catch it. And in the back of their mind, they're wondering if Officer Krumke is undercover or in uniform and hiding in one of the work cabinets, you know, that the MTA will store either the mops and the brooms that they never use because the platforms are so dirty and the stations are so dirty. But it's a great hiding place to meet your quota and make arrests. But that ain't happening anymore. And there's already a lot of fare evasion. There's already a lot of folks jumping the turnstiles. And you can tell by service levels. Now, the MTA will never level with you, but I will. Why is it that the L train, always on-time performance, they hit their marks every 2 minutes for the hipsters and millennials, especially when you go from Bedford Avenue, the last stop in Brooklyn before you hit First Avenue in Manhattan, all the way now to Bushwick, Aberdeen. That's right. That's right. Don't lie to me, Justin. You colonizers, you invaders who come in here have now pushed your way all the way to Bushwick, Aberdeen. You're like just two stops away to Broadway Junction in the heart of East New York and Brownsville. Never ran, never will. You'll be taking over those neighborhoods soon. But all those hipsters and millennials pay their fare because they're figuring like, oh, I don't want mommy in Montana or Idaho or Iowa to get a call that says I've been incarcerated. Oh, no, no, no. Because they're in fear, fright, hysteria of anything having to do with cops. So what happens is they look at the figures at the MTA, J Street Borough Hall in Brooklyn, where all those schmucks and putzes work and just contribute to the image that we have, the money-taking agency. And they figure out the patterns of where the money is coming in and where it's not. So if you notice, the L train has great service. The A train, the service sucks. It's like one of the worst lines in the city because there are so many fare evaders and turnstile jumpers along the way, especially when you start at Broadway Junction, East New York, and you hit Rockaway, and then all of a sudden you hit Franklin Avenue, and next thing you know, you're at J Street Borough Hall itself, and then it starts to normalize a bit. Yeah, that's how they configure whose trains are going to run on time and whose trains are going to be a dollar short and a day late because it's all about the schedule. Who's going to make up the difference now? With all the people jumping the fare and fare evading, we need money to repair the subway, and we're basically giving folks a license to not pay the fare. Oofa!
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa.
On the air, on the app. Curtis Sliwa, live.
My boy Curtis Sliwa.
Local.
There's a guy in a red hat.
On it.
Everybody listens to Curtis.
77 WABC.
Such a corny song. Yeah, this is what the Philadelphia Criminal Eagles have as a song. You know, it's like a throwback to when Jim Thorpe, you know, was wearing that leather helmet and playing for Carlisle, Pennsylvania, right? You know, that school for the Indian children. Come on. That is so lame. And, you know, I hate the Philadelphia Criminal Eagles. But I also hate the New England Patriots of the Brady Bunch and Coach Belichick. But on the line now to give us the over-under point spread and his impression of what's going to happen on Super Bowl Sunday is Russ Salzberg, longtime New York sportscaster. Thanks for jumping on board again, Russ.
Curtis, I got to tell you, I concur. I don't know if you hate them more than I hate them or vice versa, but I can't stand either team.
So because of that,
yes.
Because as a Giant fan growing up, I learned to despise, loathe the Philadelphia Eagles. I got to imagine if you were a Jet fan, you hate the Patriots. So do you really think anybody's going to be watching from the New York, New Jersey area other than in Southern Jersey where they're Philadelphia Eagle fans?
Yeah, they'll be watching, but you know how they're going to be watching. They're going to be watching and they're going to have all their box pools spread out on the couch and on their laps. And that's how it's kind of like a good deal for the local fans, Curtis, because they don't care who wins the damn game. They just want to see if their boxes come out all right and they win some scudol. So for them, it's a good deal. But I'll tell you, listen, every fan, every city, including New York, has their morons. You know, the morons in the stands and in the streets. But the Philly in Philadelphia, they have the most. I have never seen such ill-behaved fans in my life as those in Philadelphia. So as much as I can't stand them, though, I still give the Eagles a very legitimate shot to win this game.
And why is that?
Well, because to get after – listen, you're a Giants fan, so you know, sure, when they won their last two Super Bowls, how did they do it? They got after Tom Brady. Even if they're not sacking him, they're knocking him on his keister. They're roughing him up. They're getting after him. They're making him uncomfortable. The Eagles have a very formidable front. So to me, if you're going to beat him, that's how you have to beat him, by getting after them. The key, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm going to pick an upset here. I'm going to pick the Eagles in the upset. But the way, if they're going to do it, you can't play scared. You can't be a little sissy scaredy cat. If you get them down, don't go into this prevent garbage. That's when you got to step on their throat. You got to slam them down. It's got to become an alley fight. And too many teams don't do that. Listen, the Patriots, if you watch the game, Curtis, the Patriots were very, very lucky at home to get out and win the game against the Jaguars. The Jaguars had them by 10 points in the fourth quarter going in, and then they went into, like, snooze control. You can't do that. You got somebody down. That's when you have to play aggressive. And the guy, Peterson, the head coach of the Eagles, he's got some cajones. You know, he likes to go with it on fourth down. So maybe I'm nuts, but I'm picking the Eagles to win the game. You want a score? I'll give you a score.
Sure.
Eagles 20, the Patriots 16.
Now, you spoke originally of the action that will be waging on this game from the pools, which existed here at WABC and in almost every office across America. Right now, you got a split. You got the overpaid Roger Goodell, who says no to sports gambling.
Right.
You got the commissioner of the NBA who says yes.
Right.
Why should all this money be going either to the Cayman Islands, Costa Rica, or into the pockets of organized crime and wire rooms throughout the tri-state area?
Well, I don't know if you're going to agree with me or not, but I have an interesting take on this. And I liken it a little bit to the discussion of, and I know you've been very heavy into the discussion on legalized marijuana.
Yes.
Here's what I don't like about legalized gambling. And you bring out a good point about why should other people, including the bookies and this guy, make the money. The problem that I have with legalized gambling, Curtis, and I'm glad you brought it up, is that the minute it becomes legal, it makes it easier and more of an appetite for young people to gamble. Mm-hmm. Now, somebody might say, well, there's going to be an 18-year-old. You got to be 18 or above to do that. Listen. Did you ever go to the racetrack as a kid?
Oh, of course,
Aqueduct. I went to the racetrack as a kid, and let me tell you, I wasn't even 16 when I was going. When you start, it's like going into, when I go get my newspapers every morning, I get my five newspapers, I'm like you, we're like dinosaurs, we like reading the newspaper.
Sure.
When I go get my newspapers, I go into the little corner store, and I'm watching people who I know have trouble rubbing two nickels together. They're spending $50, $100 at a time buying lottery tickets. Why? Because it's available to them. And my concern is, and I'm not some, you know, I'm not Father Flanagan here, okay? I'm not living in a puritanical world. But when it is there, when it makes it easy, that's when kids are going to learn to gamble at a very young age.
All right.
And for that reason, I don't like it. Now, the other side that you say, why should everybody else be making the money? But that's how I feel about it. You know, it's like you say, I totally agree with, listen, you've had your health issues. Thank God you're doing well. The reason I'm on the fence with legalizing marijuana, and I don't want to digress off of sports, but I grew up, as you did, in the drug era. And I can tell you, every friend of mine, and I had quite a few who went the wrong way, it all started with a simple joint. You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, but Russ, I got to tell you, you know Father Flanagan, that's for sure. You know Gentile. You're sounding like Rebbe Russ Salzburg here. Hey. But his prediction, he didn't shrink from it. Philadelphia Eagles in an upset, 20. The Brady Bunch and Coach Belichick, 17. We'll revisit that on Monday.
Deep connections, deep understanding.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
77 WABC.
I know I'd go from rags to riches.
5:52 as we continue here in the Drive home at 5. Boy, it's been an Astoria week, right? Last Sunday, it was Tony Bennett, the Astoria kid, down on the stage in Madison Square Garden, bogarting the mic that Rihanna couldn't even get a word in edgewise. He's like suffering that first level of dementia. And then the other Astoria kid, the crazy actor, Christopher Walken, he's basically exonerated in the killing of Natalie Wood, remember, on the boat off Catalina Island. Apparently, Robert Wagner, her husband at the time, is a person of interest in the ongoing investigation. He's like 87. But that's not why we played that song by Tony Bennett. It's right out of Goodfellas. And it has to do with the federal trial going on downtown Southern District involving Joe Giuseppe Pococco. Now, you've heard the name, and you wonder, who is this guy? Why do they keep attaching him like an appendage to Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo? King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brutta Cuomo, King Cuomo I. Well, because he was like the third son. He was that close to Mario. Notice, they don't even call him, you know, dad, daddy. They refer to him as Mario. Andrew and Pretty Boy over there at CNN, you know, he's got the muscles between both ears, Chris Cuomo. And he was the leg breaker. He was the wartime consigliere. He was the muscle. He was the enforcer. And he's been charged with extortion and a shakedown of an energy company upstate in which his wife was given a, they don't even call it a no-show job. Like right out of The Sopranos, you know, the no-show job. It's a low-show job. This is a new term. Never heard of this before. Apparently, Joe Pococco's wife would give like one presentation on some subject to the suits at this energy corporation like once a month. And she'd be paid thousands and thousands of dollars, which led to about $350,000 in a kickback that Joe Pococco was being given in order to make sure that this company was taken care of by the state corrupt bureaucracy. Now, Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo claims he has window shades on his eyes, a zipper on his mouth, and cotton balls in his ears. He knows nothing. He's like Sergeant Schultz. I know nothing about this. Even though nine of his top aides have been indicted for corruption and shakedown. It wasn't looking good, though, for Joe Pococco this week in court. And it wasn't looking good for Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo. Because the federal government, that's right, decided that they would cut the federal funding of our highways in New York because Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo decided to do self-promotions at a cost of $8 million to us, the sucker taxpayers. You know, you've seen those blue signs whenever you take the highway system from Buffalo right on down to Brooklyn, the New York State Experience, you know, I love New York signs. Well, the federal government had warned him to remove them 2 years ago. He said, I don't have to do what you stinking want me to do, which is to take down those signs. So not only is it going to cost us $14 million in monies we should have accrued, but $8 million that we already dished out for the signs. That's $22 million. But my configuration, and, you know, we're not using Common Core math here because I hate that. That's $22 million he ought to be paying out of his campaign war chest. He's got $30 million to play with. And his announced candidates who want to take him out, DeFrancesco, the state senator from Syracuse, or Kolb, the minority leader of the Republicans in the Assembly, or Jason Giambra, the former county executive in Erie County, combined, I don't even think, have $1 million yet in this campaign. So he should pay. And then there is a law that says you cannot put up billboards because it is a distraction to drivers. Many of you right now are driving through the Queens Midtown Tunnel and getting clipped, you know, with the, what do they call that, the wireless toll now. And as you're driving towards Long Island or the Grand Central, you're noticing on the left, right as you're passing the old Maspeth incinerator, which doesn't operate, and Calvary and Mount Zion, and you see all these solitary slabs in the cemetery, do you realize, look at all those billboards that look like they have been vulturized, vandalized, that are empty. making it look like when you enter the city over the LIE into the Queens Midtown Tunnel, or you're leaving the city on your way to JFK or LaGuardia, it's like a scene out of Mad Max. Remember Mel Gibson's breakout film, which was apocalyptic? Now, if in fact there are highway rules that have been set up by the federal government that you cannot have billboards that are distracting to drivers, why are those empty billboards still up? And they've been up for more than a dozen years. Somebody's gotten kickbacks. And Curtis Sliwa not only wants to know, but I'm going to use my schnoz to smell out who's been wine, dined, and pocket lined on this. And I bet you all roads lead to the contributors, to Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the guy who thinks over my dead body is going to be the next president.